Chapter 4. The Sewing Center of Khasuruzgan. We walked uphill, my Afghan guide and I, stepping between the naked brambles, using the larger rocks as leverage. We continued until the larches thinned away, until the air cut cold and sharp. After a while, there were no more camel thorns, no more boulders, just pure reddish soil straight to the summit. At the top, lungs burning, we looked out. For miles and miles, nothing but the crumpled earth. Deep ferrous rocks and crimson-brown sand. It was as if we were the last two humans on the planet, as if we'd lost ourselves in some endless red emptiness. The only interruption was far off in the distance, a pair of mountains capped in pure white snow. The melted runoff dribbled down the sides, coalescing into five or six rivulets that merged into a tiny stream near the basin. And there, around the stream, nestled between the two mountains, was a tiny, solitary patch of green. People lived there. Since the beginning, Afghanistan has been a country of valleys. Only 12% of Afghan soil is arable, just half of which is actually cultivated due to water scarcity, making the nation one of the driest, roughest-hewn patches of territory in the world. What water can be had is usually scoured from the mountains, the single immutable feature of country life. Life on the slopes themselves can be a struggle, so Afghans tend to live around the mountains or between them, huddled together in narrow dales. It can take days to travel from one valley to the next. Unsurprisingly, such conditions were not conducive to the development of a centralized state, either endogenously or through outside intervention. On the other hand, the conventional image of the wild, hirsute tribesmen of the Afghan frontier, perpetually fighting back modernity and foreign invaders, which in the eyes of said invaders were invariably the same thing, doesn't tell the whole story either. Before the modern era, Afghanistan was not, in fact, a graveyard of empires. Some foreign campaigners proved victorious, such as the Arab and Persian armies that, over centuries, brought Islam, and others regarded the country as nothing more than a convenient buffer, looking beyond it for riches. The British, for instance, may have fought and lost battles on Afghan soil, but the real prize was India. For a long time, the people of the Afghan valleys herded sheep and goats. Wealth in pastoral societies is a peculiar thing, because being on the hoof, it can wander off or be pilfered or slaughtered. With too little to go around, and no state to enforce property relations, fighting could be frequent and brutal. You adapted by leaning on those you trusted most. First, your immediate family, then your cousins' cousins, and so on. Clannishness, in other words, was not a symptom of Afghans' preternaturally backward ways, but rather a sensible response to harsh and precarious conditions. Over time, the mountain dwellers developed complicated kinship networks of trust and solidarity, organized into groups called tribes that they believed had descended from a common ancestor. Hundreds of Pashtun tribes, large and small, are scattered across the country. In the lawless mountains, you needed strategies, conscious or otherwise, to survive. On the one hand, you had to stay ready to defend yourself against slights and intrusions, as there was no outside authority. No central government to call upon. On the other, it was no less prudent to attempt to elicit the best in others, to promote generosity and hospitality. In fact, the two approaches tended to work in tandem, typifying what some sociologists call a culture of honor. Of course, Afghan tribal society, with its feuding clans and warm hospitality, is the prototypical honor culture. But to varying degrees, you can find such societies wherever life is rugged, resources scarce, and the state absent. From the deserts of Arabia to the highlands of Scotland, and even closer to home in the 19th century Appalachian foothills of the Hatfields and the McCoys. For the ancient Pashtun mountain families, anything that marauding rivals could plunder was worth protecting and controlling, and this included women. Females were a family commodity. In some cases, mountain clans even tattooed their animals and their women with the same markings. As pastoralists settled into sedentary agricultural life, the intimate clustering of village communities curtailed women's freedoms even further. A woman became the embodiment of her family's honor, always signaling through her behavior the virtues of her parents and siblings. To safeguard this honor, families cloistered their women in the home, separating them completely from unrelated menfolk. Men inhabited the public square, women the private. This practice of seclusion, called purda, became the dominant form of sexual organization in much of rural southern Afghanistan, varying in degree from village to village, but almost always present in some form. If a woman needed to venture into the public sphere, purda was preserved symbolically through the burqa. Again, there's nothing quintessentially Afghan or Islamic about purda. It predates Islam and can also be found in non-Muslim contexts, such as in certain Indian Hindu villages. To mention all of this is not to say that purda is the natural state of things. Indeed, there is no immutable natural state. Afghan societies, like all societies, are forever transforming themselves. By the 20th century, purda's emotional and symbolic power had driven urban elites into a culture war with traditional rural forces. Over decades, reformers campaigned to dismantle the system, their movement culminating in the 1959 decision that allowed women to unveil and may have helped spark violent riots in Kandahar that left 60 people dead. By the 1970s, life in cities like Kabul, where women went to school, took jobs, and married relatively late, felt ages removed from the Pashtun countryside. Following the Soviet invasion, the communists, to their credit, passed decrees making girls' education compulsory and abolishing certain oppressive tribal customs, such as the bride price, a payment to the bride's family in return for her hand in marriage. However, by massacring thousands of tribal elders, they paved the way for the commanders to step in as the new elite. Aided by American and Saudi patronage, extremism flourished. What had once been a social practice confined to areas deep in the hinterlands now became a political practice, which, according to ideologues, applied to the entire country. The modest gains of urban women were erased.
"The first time a woman enters her husband's house," Hila told me about life in the countryside, "she wears white," her wedding dress, "and the first time she leaves, she wears white," the color of the Muslim funeral shroud. The rules of this arrangement were intricate and precise, and it seemed to Hila unchanged from time immemorial. In Uruzgan, a woman did not step outside her compound. In an emergency, she required the company of a male blood relative to leave, and then only with her father's or husband's permission. Even the sound of her voice carried a hint of subversion, so she was kept out of hearing range of unrelated males. When the man of the house was not present, boys were dispatched to greet visitors. Unrelated males also did not inquire directly about a female member of the house. Asking, "How is your wife?" qualified as somewhere between uncomfortably impolite and downright boorish. The markers of a woman's life, births, anniversaries, funerals, prayers, feasts, existed entirely within the four walls of her home. Gossip, hopscotching from living room to living room, was carried by husbands or sons. In 1994, the civil war was in its second year. Every attempt to cobble together some sort of détente between the rival factions had failed spectacularly. The Russians and the Americans, whose interventions had brought this state of affairs about, had lost all interest in the country. Osama bin Laden was living in Sudan, and Al-Qaeda, as we know it today, did not yet exist. Nor did the Taliban. Instead, a country of 30 million that had once been the center of the Cold War was now quietly and anonymously devouring itself. Late that summer, Hila settled into Muskanyar's ancestral home in a corner of Uruzgan province called Khas Uruzgan, Khas meaning special, the district having been the provincial capital ages ago. Although fighting was less intense than in Kabul, here too, rival warlords, chief among them John Muhammad, were locked in a bloody power struggle, leaving the road dotted with rogue checkpoints and militia posts. But Hila's concerns lay closer at hand. In the countryside, a woman was expected to work long and hard at keeping up her home, and in a way this was a blessing. Hila threw herself into the task of remaking their inherited house, which had sat empty for more than a decade. The squat, one-story structure was designed to honor the local virtues of family, privacy, and hospitality. A large compound wall of tawny mud bricks surrounded the property, with holes punched through to examine visitors. Upon entering, you found yourself in a small courtyard where weeds and crabgrass had edged onto the walkway. To the left sat a guest room, the quintessential mark of a southern home, set off by itself so that visitors might not inadvertently glimpse a female. A pair of apple trees stood near the opposite wall. It took about 20 paces to get from the main gate to the front door. The house itself measured about 50 feet to a side and consisted of a number of narrow rooms arranged in a railroad fashion. The living room walls remained bare because Hila hadn't been able to bring photos from Kabul. Beneath the house was a small cellar. In the backyard, a vegetable patch grew near the door and privet lined the mud walls. In the far corner stood a tiny chicken coop. Had Hila been able to leave the compound, she would have found a bucolic hamlet of maybe 50 homes, each very much like hers. There was no main road. Instead, a web of narrow dirt tracks ran between the farmers' fields, connecting one house to the next. The village was bounded on one side by a muddy stream, which ran just a few hundred feet from her house, and on the other by rock formations that rose rapidly skyward into a set of looming massifs. An old wooden footbridge crossed the stream to a grassy embankment, from which a gravel road led to the bazaar. Hila's village was one among dozens that peppered the basin of the mountain range, which stretched as far as she could see. In total, some 50,000 souls called Khasuruzgan district their home, most of them farmers and herders. If the women rarely left their homes, the men did not venture much farther. Some had never set foot outside the district in their lives. Out here, you lived by nature's rhythms, rising and returning with the sun, growing the food your family ate, and sewing the clothes they wore. Without electricity, there were no televisions or telephones, although by the late 1990s, hand-cranked radios were making an appearance. To hear the latest news, you headed down to the bazaar, a ramshackle row of windowless one-room shops fashioned out of old shipping containers, each with corrugated iron shutters and straw flooring. Out in front hung signs advertising Iranian colas, Pakistani biscuits, spare tires, and jerry cans of gasoline, which you could purchase once a week when the fuel truck came through. The shops flanked an uneven dirt road, on one end of which stood the government office, where the local governor normally lived, and on the other, an old schoolhouse. In 1994, both were vacant. When a car passed through, men and boys would step out of their shops and look. The nearest town, Uruzgan's capital, Tirinkot, lay 7 hours away on a highway that ran through multiple militia checkpoints. Even in more peaceful times, however, news came slowly. When the Americans appeared in 2001, some villagers assumed that the white-skinned interlopers were the Soviets. After selling some of his inherited land, Muskinyar opened a small pharmacy in the heart of the bazaar. At first, with roadblocks and bandits, it had taken weeks for goods to reach the village. By autumn, they were not arriving at all. Prices soared, and the family relied on Muskinyar's brother, Shesta, who had resorted to subsistence farming. Almost daily, bodies were being dumped in the mountains, victims of war and hunger. There were days when Muskinyar stood with Hila in the backyard, looking at those snow-capped peaks as if they were some premonition of the winter and the hardship to come, as if death were now the common order of the land, the only principle binding country and city, men and women, holy warriors and communists alike. And it may well have become so, if not for a new force that arose suddenly in the south to change everything. Drive away from Uruzgan, taking the sole rutted pebble road running southeast. You'll cross miles of low open brush in Ghazni province, then wheat fields and apricot thickets, and farther on, dry scrubland again, leading up to the barren gravel hills of the province of Pakhtika. In 3 decades of war, much has changed, but in this corner of the country, you can still find a smattering of hill tribes clinging, against the odds, to their old ways of life. They make a good starting point for those looking to excavate Afghanistan's distant past. Surprisingly, however, they also carry a more contemporary relevance. a glimpse into the obscure origins of the Taliban. Most writing on the Taliban assumes that they originated in the extremist Pakistani madrasas in the 1980s. In fact, the group's origins lie much deeper in the Afghan past. Visiting Pakhtika in 2010, I came upon a small hilltop village where locals had gathered around a silent, downcast man. Nearby, a young herder paced back and forth, watching him intently, and off to the side, tribal graybeards stood conferring. One of them approached, pushing his way through the scrum, and announced a verdict. For killing Rahim Gul's cow, Moheb John was to pay him 2 sheep and 20 days' worth of labor. Afterward, I sat down with the elder, who explained that each transgression in his community carried a fixed fine. Break someone's nose in a fight, and you gave him a chicken. Break a bone, and you surrendered a sheep or goat. Murder, depending on the circumstances, could cost you a piece of land, your house, or even one of your women, who would go to the victim's family in marriage. This was how the hills people had learned to live with each other in a world without a state, or police, or judicial system. Each tribe had its own set of intricate rules, decided by elders elected by the clan's entire male population. The elders derived their status from experience and the respect traditionally accorded to the aged. No man, however, outranked another in rights, and it was rare for one family to possess significantly more than any other. For men, at least, a deep egalitarian ethos ran through the tribal system. For a long time, most of the Pashtun belt had functioned this way. Eventually, however, when some tribes moved down from the mountains into agricultural settlements, certain enterprising individuals developed ties with distant state authorities, and soon hierarchies sprang up. In 18th century Kandahar, for example, the Safavid Empire of Persia had established suzerainty, incorporating tribal figures of their liking into their military or using them as intermediaries in dealing with the native population. The egalitarian system of the mountains slowly gave way to one dominated by tribal strongmen, and decisions were increasingly made not through traditional tribal law, but on the whims and biases of a small clique of notables. It was not long before Kandahari tribes were the most thoroughly hierarchical in the country. As a consequence, a different form of justice grew in popularity as an alternative to the tribal system, religious law, or Sharia. Like tribal law, religious law expressed itself in a detailed set of punishments and restitutions for particular crimes. Its main practitioners were mullahs, who led Friday sermons and could adjudicate disputes. To become a mullah, you studied for up to 12 years in a madrasa, where you learned the intricacies of Islamic law, along with history, philosophy, and logic. In Pashto, such students were called Taliban. Because a mullah was guaranteed employment for life, this was a course of study particularly well-suited to those from the humblest backgrounds. It was in Greater Kandahar, where tribal structures were the weakest, that the Taliban were most fully integrated into social life. In times of strife, Taliban have usually mobilized in defense of tradition. British documents from as early as 1901 decry Taliban opposition to colonialism in present-day Pakistan. However, as with so much else, it was the Soviet invasion and the U.S. response that sent the transformative shock. In the 1980s, as guns and money coursed through the ranks of the Kandahar Mujahideen, squabbling over resources grew so frequent that many increasingly turned to religious law to settle their disputes. Small informal bands of Taliban, who were also battling against the Russians, established religious courts that heard cases from feuding fighters from across the south. Seemingly impervious to the lure of foreign riches, the Taliban courts were in many eyes the last refuge of tradition in a world in upheaval. After the Soviet withdrawal, intra-Mujahideen bickering exploded into outright warfare, but the Talibs would have no part of it and put their weapons down, retiring to a life of preaching and study. They watched as Kandahar plunged into a civil war as brutal and rapacious as Kabul's, a near-total breakdown of society with rogue gunmen and militias running wild. In the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king, and in Kandahar, this one-eyed man turned out to be a small-time Taliban preacher named Mullah Muhammad Omar. A minor figure known only for his bravery, he lost his eye in battle against the Soviets, he was part of a burgeoning movement of Talibs looking to end the terror. With an unfailing air of simplicity and modesty, Omar was seen as less politically ambitious than his colleagues, and was soon anointed by the movement as its leader. "The religion of God is being stepped on. The people are openly displaying evil," he said in a speech at the time, "and the evil ones have taken control of the whole area. They steal people's money. They attack their honor on the main street. They kill people and put them against the rocks on the side of the road, and the cars pass by and see the dead body on the side of the road, and no one dares to bury him in the earth." Thousands of Talibs rallied to the cause, and an informal centuries-old phenomenon of the Pashtun countryside morphed into a formal political and military movement, the Taliban. As a group of judges and legal-minded students, the Taliban applied themselves to the problem of anarchy with an unforgiving platform of law and order. The Mujahideen had lost their way, abandoned their religious principles, and dragged society into a lawless pit. So unlike most revolutionary movements, Islamic or otherwise, the Taliban did not seek to overthrow an existing state and substitute it with one to their liking. Rather, they sought to build a new state where none existed. This called for eliminating the arbitrary rule of the gun and replacing it with the rule of law. And for countryside judges who had arisen as alternatives to broken tribal systems, this could only mean religious law. Jurisprudence is thus part of the Taliban's DNA, but its single-minded pursuit was carried out to the exclusion of all other aspects of basic governance. It was an approach that flirted dangerously with the wrong kind of innovation. In the countryside, the choice was traditionally yours whether to seek justice in religious or in tribal courts. Yet now the Taliban mandated religious law as the compulsory law of the land. It is true that given the nature of the civil war, any law was better than none at all. But as soon as things settled down, fresh problems arose. The Taliban's jurisprudence was syncretic, mixing elements from disparate schools of Islam, along with heavy doses of traditional countryside Pashtun practice that had little to do with religion. As a result, once the Taliban marched beyond the rural Pashtun belt and into cities like Kabul or the ethnic minority regions of northern Afghanistan, they encountered a resentment that rapidly bred opposition. So the Taliban's history is fraught with complication. But the important point is that they, like so many other factions in Afghanistan, were never an alien force. Rather, they were as Afghan as kebabs or the Hindu Kush, a fact that U.S. soldiers would learn the hard way. When winter came to Khasuruzgan, the meadows were left yellow and ruined, the mountain passes and roads buried under snow. Life retreated indoors, and no news from the outside would come until springtime. It had always been that way, until one winter afternoon in early 1995, when a neighbor came by to inform Muskanyar that the war was over. When Muskanyar reached the bazaar, he saw Toyota jeeps with rocket launchers piled in the back and some mullahs milling nearby. The big landowning families and the major warlords were surrendering their weapons to the new authorities. If the men of the bazaar rejected the rule of the Taliban mullahs, they did not show it. Instead, they approached one after another to kiss their hands and thank God for peace. As the weeks passed, it transpired that life went on much as before, except that now you could drive the breadth of the district without worry, which meant that the shops were stocked once again and the prices settled back down to reason. Hila watched the events with little interest. There was no whip-wielding religious police because the men of Khasuruzgan had beards and prayed regularly anyway. There was no shuttering of girls' schools or orders for women to stay indoors because there had been no such schools to begin with and women were confined to the home as it was. With no TVs or cameras, the ban on moving images meant nothing. Hila might have disliked the injunction against music, but the civil war had already rendered outdoor music parties obsolete, and no one would stop her from listening to her cassettes in the privacy of her own home. In time, as Muskanyar returned in the evenings to relate the news of the day, she grew to appreciate her new rulers. She was pleased to learn that authorities were clamping down on the tribal practice of using females to settle feuds, for which they found no sanction in their version of religious law. They were even prepared to look the other way when the stubborn details of state-making clashed with deeply held beliefs. When the wife of Mullah Abbas, the new Taliban minister of health, fell ill, he ran up against the prohibition of contact between women and male doctors and nurses, which had created a dire shortage of female medical practitioners. In response, he pushed for the creation of a nurse training program in Kabul. One afternoon in 1998, Abbas, a Khasuruzgan native, called Muskanyar to explain that Hila, as one of the few educated women in the district, had been selected to participate. Hila and two others, with chaperones, were taken in a van across a gutted country, a long highway that lay ruined but bandit-free. They arrived in the city of her birth on a quiet spring day. From the car, she stared at what had become of her childhood streets. Crippled beggars wheeling themselves about, roads torn seemingly beyond repair, almost no traffic anywhere, whole neighborhoods lying in apocalyptic ruins. She turned away, wondering how Muslims could have done this to themselves. For 6 months, she trained under the watchful eye of her Taliban supervisors and was not allowed outdoors even once. But the work was engaging, and as she roomed with women from other provinces, it almost felt like her university days. She learned midwifery and basic nursing, and it filled her with hope that she might be able to make Khasuruzgan her own, that she might carve out a future for herself there. Back home, news of a woman with medical skills spread quickly through the village. Husbands started to bring in their pregnant wives or ailing mothers. For many women, it was their first trip outside in years. Some even feigned illness for the opportunity. From her patients, Hila learned that extended confinement had varied psychological effects. For some, the compound walls so completely delineated the limits of their universe that they had developed something akin to agoraphobia. For others, especially those who had had a taste of freedom in childhood, the internment of married life plunged them into depression. One favored method of suicide was self-immolation. Another was throwing oneself down a well. A third group, certainly the largest, adapted to their confinement, if only because it was the sole world they had ever known. Although she was a transplant, Hila herself had been slipping into this last category as the demands of the household and her growing family consumed her. After Umayd had come Jamshed, now rapidly turning into a sprightly toddler, and then Nawid and Walid, baby boys born just a year apart. Weeks and months bled into years, and the 1990s drew to a close. "We all thought," she said, "that life would just go on that way. Forever." The first snows had already set upon the lower slopes of the ranges behind Hila's house in the autumn of 2001, when Muskanyar heard a terse radio proclamation. The Taliban government was finished. At the bazaar, he saw some shopkeepers standing nervously about, and nothing more. The governor's house stood vacant, and village elders had gathered in a nearby home, preparing to elect a new government. Within weeks, the air began to throb day and night with the sound of helicopters. In December, a 12-foot-high barbed wire fence appeared in a desert clearing near the bazaar, curling around a set of massive camouflage tents. Sandbags were piled high out front, and a group of Afghans, whom villagers did not recognize, stood watch outside. Hila greeted these events with as little interest as the previous change of power, 8 years prior. Life began and ended within her compound walls, a life in which dreams and memories were lost or deadened, leaving only the incessant din of daily being. Her days started before sunrise. "In our area," she recalled, "if a woman doesn't wake up before the morning prayer call, they say she isn't really a woman." After praying, she headed for the tandoor, a clay oven dug into the ground used for making naan. She stoked the fire with wood collected the day before and then loaded the oven. Muskanyar and the boys rose at dawn, and they all sat around a communal breakfast of warm bread and green tea. Sometimes she would watch Muskanyar as they ate. He was always dapper, his clothes unstained and freshly pressed. It never ceased to surprise her how meticulous he was, how fortune had graced her with a self-sufficient husband. After he left for work, Hila attended the goats and chickens in the backyard, put out milk to set yogurt, tidied the house, peeled vegetables, and looked after the boys, the two oldest of whom were now of school age. Caring for Muskanyar's elderly mother, who had come to live with them, was an added responsibility. In all of this, in every working day, Hila found a certain necessity to things, a growing conviction that these realities pressed upon her for a reason, and that there was much that was good and even holy in them. She knew that she had mastered homemaking as few others transplanted from the city could have, and she only wished that the rest of the village could see it for themselves. One elderly woman who sometimes visited with vague medical complaints said that Hila's was the cleanest, most orderly house she'd seen in her years. But in general, guests were rare. During harvest season, women would be busy in their courtyards cleaning and drying the apricots and almonds that their husbands had brought home, and it was only during growing season that there was time for medical concerns. Patients dribbled into Hila's house at a rate of about one per month. Usually they would complain of highly nonspecific ailments, but occasionally, a pregnant woman would present with symptoms of anemia. Without access to a clinic, there was little Hila could do beyond offering dietary advice. Sometimes, in severe cases, she dispatched the patient's male blood relative escort, her marem, to a mullah, or a peregrinate Sufi saint, to collect an amulet containing a Quranic verse suited to the problem at hand. It was well into the springtime of that first post-Taliban year before she saw a sign of change. A shipment of medicines donated by the U.S. government arrived at the new base and was subsequently parceled out to community leaders. Hila could now prescribe iron pills. Shortly after, an NGO showed up to remove mines left over from the Soviet war. It was the first time, as far as anyone could remember, that an international aid group had ever visited the area. Then that summer, workers from another agency appeared to distribute seeds to nearby farmers. Muskinyar began to see the world anew. Ex-communists around the country were embracing the U.S.-backed government. Many were even working directly for the Americans, and he didn't want to be left behind. He began making trips to the base to meet soldiers, who were members of the U.S. Special Forces, and he often took Omid along. In the evenings, he would regale Hila with tales of his visits. Old dreams were dusted off and updated. For the first time in years, he spoke of traveling abroad. He promised that Germany awaited, and maybe even Mecca, too, where they would make their holy pilgrimage together. And just like that, Hila felt the tug herself, that something inside her that had driven her to economics at university against her parents' advice, that something that had given her the courage to travel cross-country with Taliban officials to study nursing. It was pulling at her again. It had now been 4 long years since she'd last set eyes upon anything outside the main wall of her compound. 4 years of births and meals and quarrels. Life lived, no doubt. But she wanted more. When Muskinyar came home in the evenings, she started to beg him to take her somewhere, even just for an afternoon. She had no idea how such a feat could be accomplished, but she didn't see why they shouldn't try. The trouble was, Muskinyar did not have the slightest idea how to pull this off either. If villagers caught Hila walking about outdoors, the gossiping and backbiting and the resulting shame could be enough to tear apart the strongest family. Not long before, there had been the case of a woman of marriageable age sighted walking alone near the bazaar, prompting folks to say that she was up to no good. Even Hila had assumed so, for what other reason could there be for a woman of that age? Sure enough, it was later learned that she had run off in an unsanctioned marriage or had turned to prostitution. She was not seen again, and the family left Uruzgan in shame. But for Hila, there was also an obstacle much closer to home. Her mother-in-law, the family's octogenarian upholder of tradition. Since marriage, Muskinyar's mother had left her house only a handful of times in her life, and she spoke with the stubborn authority of someone who knew that this was the way things had always been and would always be. She saw it as her duty to protect the family name, especially since her daughter-in-law had arrived with her Kabul ways. Muskinyar thought hard for some days, and then he announced to his mother one afternoon that Hila had fallen sick and needed to be rushed to a nurse on the far side of the district. The old woman demurred, insisting that exposing Hila would do the family more harm than having her sick in bed for a few weeks. "And if she gets worse?" he asked. "Do you want to be responsible?" She had no reply. Hila, listening in the next room, ear to the door, could not believe the ruse was working. After dinner, she fitted herself into a mud-green burqa and stepped outside, following Muskanyar and the children. She didn't know where they were headed, but she didn't care. The sun sat low and fat and pink on the horizon. Through the burqa mesh, she could make out Muskanyar's sandals swinging into and out of view. They headed along the dirt path leading to the stream. Holding his hand, she crossed the wooden footbridge and stepped into the back seat of the car, which was always parked on the far embankment. Muskanyar drove them to the bazaar, by now almost shut down for the night. Around this time, boys would bring their goats into town to feed on the garbage heaped by the roadside, a de facto sanitation service. The children working the shops would be busy pulling down the rusted iron shutters. Their sunburned grandfathers would be squatting nearby, repeating their tired tales. Yet even in its crumbling decay, the bazaar still showed some signs of the new era. A poster of a Bollywood starlet. A small satellite dish perched atop a shop. They waited until the street was clear, Hila ducking out of sight, and then rolled slowly toward the shops. As they pulled up to Muskanyar's store, she could just make out, through her mesh, the flowing cursive script on the window. Kabul Pharmacy. Inside, the dusty shelves were choked with Chinese and Pakistani-made medicines. With no hospitals for miles, this was it. You addressed your healthcare needs here, at Muskanyar's pharmacy, or you didn't address them at all. Today, he told her with a smile, you are my guest. Take whatever you like. Hila shuffled through the rows of chalky white boxes as the boys scurried here and there. Six-year-old Jamshed hoisted himself onto a chair behind the glass counter and pounded his fist. I am a doctor, he announced. Hila wished her Kabul friends could see her now, out again, reclaiming her place in the world. One of the boys knocked over a pile of medicines. Hila shrieked and spanked him, but Muskanyar burst out laughing. The muezzin crooned and the sky darkened. She selected a few boxes to take home, including a drug that cured headaches and another that protected against the evil eye. The trip lasted less than an hour, but Hila felt like the luckiest woman in Khasuruzgan. Although she would experience much in the years to come, this would be the only family outing she would ever have. It was a summer's day in 2002, a day so hot that Hila was avoiding the garden altogether, when someone rapped on the front door. Muskanyar was at work and the boys at school, so she did not answer. But the knocking continued, and finally the visitor called out her name. She pressed her face against the metal gate and carefully said, Who is it?
Kudus Khan, said the voice.
It was the district governor, one of the most powerful men in Khasuruzgan. He was also in charge of an NGO that operated on foreigner-donated funds.
I'm sorry, she said self-consciously. My husband isn't here.
No, we'd like to speak with you. We heard there's an educated woman in this house.
That's me, she said through the closed door. I can read and write.
The governor told her that they had received funding to establish a female vocational training center and needed someone to help oversee the project. Would she be interested? Hila stood staring at the door. It took a moment for the words to register. She knew that this sort of opportunity came along only once or twice in a lifetime. But turning around, she saw her mother-in-law standing, with her arms folded like a warlord, she recalled.
Thank you for your offer, she said, but I don't want to work.
Kudus Khan insisted that she was the perfect person for the job, since they didn't know of anyone else who had experience outside the house. Hila was at a loss. She glanced around to her mother-in-law and finally said,
It isn't my decision. Please, talk to my husband when he comes home.
As soon as he left, her mother-in-law walked up to her.
What's wrong with you? How could you let those men hear your voice? You're going to make trouble for my son, aren't you?
Hila ignored her and went inside. She was feeling that tug again, and her mind raced with possibilities. Although she knew of no female in her village who had successfully worked outside the house, she didn't see why she couldn't be the first. Confidence was a rare currency, and ironically, her stint working under the Taliban had endowed her with more than any woman she knew. That evening, Muskanyar jumped at the news.
9 years of village life had not yet eradicated the last vestiges of his former world. The two began conspiring to get Hila the job. Fortunately, the position only required twice monthly visits to the vocational center. The furtive trip to his shop had convinced him that if planned carefully, it would be possible to smuggle her to the center and back without discovery. The only challenge, as always, was his mother. After a day of discussion, he dreamed up a cover story. He would be taking Hila to visit the village shrine. When he tested the idea with his mother, she shot back, "What good is a woman her age going to the shrine? The holiest work is here with me, in the kitchen." Muskinyar countered that with his newfound religiosity, he preferred a more observant wife. And it was true that he had taken to the Quran, even growing out his beard like the rest of the village. Would she actually stand in the way of religion? There was nothing that could rightfully be said to this, and she knew it. On the appointed day, Hila awoke earlier than usual and fished out her most respectable outfit, holding it up for inspection. The burqa was loose and flowing, sandy brown like the earth. She set it aside and readied breakfast, then proceeded to finish her chores for the day. It was not yet mid-morning when she and Muskanyar and the children, along for effect, loaded themselves into the station wagon. As they drove the long back road around the village, she caught herself telling rambling stories, her habit when anxious. The car pulled up to a nondescript house, and Muskanyar scanned the area, then motioned for Hila to get out. She had taken only a few steps when a man on a bicycle appeared on the horizon, pedaling toward them. She jumped back into the car. He sped by without looking up. Hila got out again, and this time nearly ran to the gate. Inside, a group of women trainees were crowded together in a small room, hunched over sewing machines. Most were Hazaras, whose families tended to take a slightly more permissive approach to Purda than the Pashtuns of her village. Still, like Hila, they had all endured significant risks to come, and as the machines sputtered along, the mood was tense. It was 2002. The Taliban had been gone for almost a year, and the Americans were busy building a new Afghanistan. Yet in Khasruzgan, these women had no choice but to work in secret. Everyone there knew the stakes. If word leaked, they would almost certainly be accused of prostitution, a charge that, under the strictures of village life, was usually punishable by death. Hila was to be an auditor, ensuring that none of the students or teachers made off with the materials. As thrilling as it was, she was not happy to linger. She kept glancing at the door, expecting village men to burst in at any moment. She took down the inventory and hurried back to Muskanyar's waiting car. At home, her mother-in-law asked, "Did you go to the shrine?" "Yes," Hila replied. "Did you pray for me?" "Yes." One evening a month later, Muskanyar arrived home with a wad of cash and handed it to Hila. She counted it. 8,500 Pakistani rupees. Nearly $150. She looked at him. "Take it," he said. Hila knew that she'd be getting paid, but the amount still came as a shock. She handed it back, saying it belonged to him, the man of the house. He pushed it right back into her hands. "It's yours," he said. "You've earned it. It's your right." Hila hadn't gone to work for the money, but holding the cash in her hand, she felt a gravitas like she'd never experienced. Still, she knew of no women keeping money they had earned. It belonged to the family, to the husband. But it was clear to her that Muskanyar was serious. Had something like this ever happened in the village before? That night, before bed, she sewed a pocket into her dress to hide the money, as if Quduz Khan might come to his senses and snatch it back at any moment. Every 2 weeks, Hila engaged in a ritual of deceit with her mother-in-law. And every month, a new wad of cash arrived. It felt as if she were rediscovering her old self. On those rare occasions when elderly female relatives visited the house, she spoke more knowingly and confidently. She knew that despite their age, they would never understand the world the way that she did, or see what she'd seen. "I stopped thinking only about my children and my four walls," she recalled. "I thought about my village and Afghans everywhere." Occasionally she sent the boys out to the bazaar to buy small gifts for Muskanyar. Sometimes they made a game of it.
We got dice and made bets, me and him, she said. The kids were always supporting him. I usually lost and would send the boys to buy him clothes. I think I pick out nicer clothes anyway, so this worked in my favor. Then, once we played and he said, if you win, I'll buy you a necklace. I finally won, and it was a gold necklace. I still have it.
Cut into the stream in front of Hila's house at various points were small canals and irrigation ditches, which fanned out to the farms of the villages. Few households owned plots outright. Instead, most land belonged to the Khan, who functioned as a feudal lord of sorts, with villagers working as sharecroppers. Nearly every village had at least one Khan. Some, like Khasuruzgan Governor Quduz Khan, were prominent district-wide, but most were known just in their own village. The Khans of Khasuruzgan had risen to power only in the previous 30 years, when the old elite fled or were killed off by the communists, and they had climbed to their positions through expert management of CIA-sourced funds and land grabs. Muskinyar kept up good relations with Haji Abdu Khan, the Khan of their village, as a matter of politics, but he and Hila knew that he was a cause of much poverty. And when the village received aid money, it was understood that Abdu Khan would take a cut. Still, only with his tacit approval was the sewing center able to function at all. That small room with no windows and a dozen old sewing machines was the sole space where women regularly gathered outside their home anywhere in Khasuruzgan, save the Hazara areas. A girls' school existed on paper, but only to soothe foreign powers and Western aid agencies, as there was no actual facility. In fact, there had never been a girls' school in the village. When the communists declared female education compulsory, they had toyed with the possibility of threatening recalcitrant families with jail time, but a series of uprisings in Kandahari villages against the idea led them to back off. The communists may have believed that they were imposing modernization on the backward countryside, but from the farmer's point of view, a household could not function without women doing the necessary work indoors. With no jobs waiting for high school graduates, villagers could only see potential ruin in allowing their daughters outside. Not much had changed in the years since, except that two decades of jihadi war had left Purda with a thick Islamic gloss. So everyone involved in the sewing enterprise, Haji Abdu Khan included, took great care to keep the effort under wraps, lest they be accused of abandoning their religion. It took nearly 3 months for talk to start bubbling up around the district of the strange building where women had been seen entering. Hila took the news as a sort of inevitability, as if freedom, like all things in a world forged by war, was fleeting by its very nature. Yet even after Quduz Khan shut down the center to avoid trouble, she held on to those 3 months and did not let them go. The tug within her was nearly constant. It occurred to her that she now understood how the sewing business worked better than anyone. She had spent hours checking machines and spool stocks and fabric supplies. She knew what risks the women were taking to learn the trade, what she was risking herself just to check on them. Why couldn't she run a center herself, right in her own home? Muskinyar did not even need to hear the details of her proposal. I'll arrange it with Quduz Khan in the morning, he said, and get some machines. The following day, under cover of darkness, Muskinyar and Omaid unloaded sewing machines from the car and carried them down to the cellar. In return for the donations, they had agreed to provide dresses for Quduz Khan to sell. The governor would quietly put word out about Hila's medical practice. On the first day of sewing class in that cramped cellar, 14 women showed up. They would return once a month, each using her own brand of subterfuge. Niloufar, who might have been 17, though no one knew for sure, feigned illness to come. Mina snuck out in the afternoons when her family was taking its midday nap, dressed in black, the color of the elderly, who were ordinarily allowed to pass without notice. Getting caught would likely have meant death, but she kept coming back. Nazo waited until the men in her house were asleep to cross the fields. At her advanced age, she would not have been punished as severely as the others. But then she started bringing her two granddaughters. When her son-in-law discovered the excursions, he was incensed. With some effort, she convinced him that she needed help getting to the doctor. Nonetheless, after the third class, he began suspecting that education was involved and confronted her, shouting,
Don't corrupt my daughters!
Nazo swore that she was doing no such thing.
Look, she insisted, I don't have any books. I don't even have a pen. I have nothing. Come, check my room.
The class, initially 2 hours, soon expanded to 4.
At first, we didn't talk about sewing at all, Hila said, but instead about how to maintain proper hygiene, how to take care of your house, keep your husband happy, time management, some useful kitchen skills, and so on. These were things I had learned in Kabul, but how could you expect these village women to know about them? I taught them about city life, about the Quran, and then how to sew. I also gave them a primary education, how to write basic things, how to do basic arithmetic.
By the 6th month, the students were learning how to operate the machines and measure cloth. Upon graduating, each was granted a table, a ruler, and to their astonishment, a working sewing machine. This created another set of difficulties, as they had to conspire to sneak the machines into their houses. Eventually, the governor awarded the materials to the men of the house, under the guise of a foreign grant. Muskanyar delivered the dresses directly to Quduz Khan, who passed them on to other district officials for sale. Hila found that she had a way with the students. For women venturing outdoors for the first time, her words came soft and reassuring. Yet they also saw in her a striking model of modernity, bedecked as she was in Kabul's sartorial splendor, baggy trousers, ankle bells, and a daub of eyeshadow. For many, she was the first woman they had ever met who had cast her eyes upon the outside world. Class size dwindled during harvest season, when men would bring home fruit for their wives to clean and dry, and fluctuated unpredictably whenever domestic difficulties broke out. Occasionally, a woman somewhere in the district would get beaten or killed, scaring the students off for a month or two. One of the students was a young woman rumored to have been kidnapped from Kabul during the Civil War, and Hila was eager to learn more. During the first sessions, the woman sat in the back without saying a word. Hila couldn't help staring at her as she worked. Did she know anyone back home? How did she end up here? On the 4th visit, Hila cautiously brought up Kabul, and the woman told her the name of her home neighborhood. Emboldened, Hila decided to ask her directly about her story at the next session. But she didn't return, and Hila never saw her again. After harvest season, the students returned and another class graduated, but the women were finding it ever more difficult to explain how they were mysteriously acquiring the skills to work the machines, and Hila lived with the constant fear that the sound of a dozen machines going at once could be heard from the outside. Worse yet, there was her mother-in-law, whom Muskanyar had sworn to secrecy. Although she hadn't impeded the classes, what after all could she do without leaving the house herself? She had stated in no uncertain terms that she found the whole enterprise dishonorable. One spring day in 2003, Hila looked up from her machine to see her mother-in-law standing at the top of the stairs.
Someone is here for you, she said.
Turning to her students, Hila motioned frantically and they scrambled, noisily pushing their machines into a corner and taking cover behind curtains. She threw on a burqa and went upstairs. Standing glowering at the gate was Jamila, a relative of her husband, a woman very clever and fat, as Hila shared later.
I killed your chickens, Jamila said.
The birds had evidently wandered into her yard.
All 9 of them.
She looked furious.
Why are you angry? I should be the one that's angry.
Those infidels gave you chickens, and they damaged my garden.
Infidels? They were from a charity.
A foreign charity? Infidels.
She slowly scanned the yard.
Forget about the chickens. I heard you are working for the infidels as well.
Hila's mouth went dry.
I'm not working for anyone, she said. Someone is lying to you.
No, the whole village is talking about it. They're saying that you're working for the infidels. You better stop it. I know what you are doing.
I've done nothing wrong,
Hila exclaimed. Her mother-in-law shuffled closer to listen. And I have an education. I have a right to work if I want to.
No, you don't, Jamila shot back. Keep going on like this, and no one will see a single family member of yours alive.
Hila's mother-in-law chimed in.
Why don't you come inside for some tea?
Hila stared at her in disbelief. Before she could say anything, Jamila strode past and made her way inside. As she sat down, she spotted a pair of baby blue burkas puddled onto the floor.
Whose are those?
She asked. Her eyes swept the room. In the cellar, a dozen women held their breaths. Hila tried to change the subject.
Have some tea and let's talk. This is between you and me. It's got nothing to do with the village. It's my fault the chickens came to your garden. It's really my fault. I'm sorry.
She waved her hand across the room.
Look around. Do you see a problem here? I'm just a simple housewife.
Jamila finished her tea and left. Hila's heart settled, and she went back to her students. After a few nervous minutes, Hila continued her lesson, and the machine started up once again. Suddenly, the cellar door burst open. Jamila stood there, aghast, with Hila's mother-in-law standing beside her. The machine stopped. The students froze. One of them broke into tears.
I'm just a widow. I have no choice, she sobbed. I have no choice.
Another said,
Please, sister, we're poor. We just need money.
People started speaking all at once, begging Jamila not to say a word. Women's lives were at stake. Hila reminded her that since they were relatives, the news would put Jamila's family in an unfavorable light as well. This finally seemed to cool her down. But before she left, she told Hila,
It's not just me. The whole village is talking. Don't be selfish. Think about your families. Think about your religion.
She paused at the top of the stairs and added,
I'm not responsible for what happens to you.
Hila canceled classes for the month, but the stoning started anyway. First, rocks rained down on the window and the roof. Then, when her boys left the house, village youths hurled stones at their heads. 1 month rolled into the next, and the students refused to return to class. It was not long before Quduz Khan sent a delegation to Hila's house to investigate why dress production had stopped. Hila answered through the door, as usual, but then grew concerned that the visitors would accidentally be stoned, so she invited them in. The four men sat cross-legged on the living room floor as she served tea and sweets. Zabit, a sweaty bear of a man, barraged her with questions about the use of the equipment. She hardly gave it a thought. That evening, when Hila related the day's events to Muskanyar, he stared at her incredulously. She could see him becoming stiff with anger.
I had to invite them in, she said. I didn't have a choice.
Without a word, he got up and walked out. This was serious, and she knew it. He almost never lost his temper. She shouldn't have brought those men in or allowed them to hear her voice, but what else could she have done? Still, it would cause problems for the family. People would talk, bemoaning how her education had gone to her head, how she acted as if she still lived in Kabul. They would blame Muskanyar for not reining her in, question his manhood and the family's purity. She found him in the front yard and tried to apologize, but he would have none of it. Hila had never seen him this way. She continued to press her case, and as she spoke, he flashed with anger and suddenly kicked her hard on the legs. As she cried out, he managed to land two more kicks. She stormed into the bedroom and slammed the door. It took more than an hour for her to cool down. Then she went to the kitchen and chopped up some vegetables and threw chunks of lamb into the pan. When the food was ready, she walked a plate out to him, but he grabbed it and hurled it across the room. For days after, she refused to speak to him. Yet even as she seethed inside, she considered herself lucky. They almost never fought, and not once had he brought up the possibility of taking a second wife, as permitted by Islam and local culture. Unlike most village men, he seldom laid a violent hand on her. This episode, in fact, would be one of just two serious fights they would have during their time in Uruzgan. Hila knew that it could be so much worse. Her neighbor Wajma, for instance, had talked back to her husband after he took a second wife, which had so enraged his family that the women of the household held Wajma down as her brother-in-law shot her dead. The new government would no more intervene in such matters than it would if you had, in some private rage, killed your own oxen or damaged your own house. So Hila was grateful for her good fortune, even though in their other serious fight, Muskanyar had broken her arm. "But that was my fault," she insisted. "I had talked back to him. Women out in the village don't talk back to their husbands. It's just a law. When men say something, women should just listen, and you should never talk in a loud voice, because a man outside might hear. I made that mistake, but I was lucky. In Tirin Kot, a man once beat his wife with an axe, and she survived, but her head was split open. Husbands who only use their hands or feet are very kind." Weeks passed before the pair could make amends, and by then the damage had been done, just as Muskanyar feared. Zabit had started a rumor that Hila was running a house of prostitution, and Jamila swore to her relatives that she had seen the girls in action. It was only by the grace of God that her students survived the beatings, some only barely so. Muskanyar closed down the school. For months, Hila had been living in stolen moments, snatched from a social structure that yielded little to women of ambition. In the end, she realized, you surrender that which you have taken, at least in Khas Uruzgan. And for the first time in years, the tug was gone. She waited patiently, but it did not return. In time, even waiting for it seemed foolish, reckless in fact, and she hated herself for having believed otherwise. She started skipping meals and letting housework go. Her slide into someplace dark was steady and perhaps irrevocable. Muskanyar, however, refused to accept it. One evening, Hila went to bed and found new jewelry on her pillow. Another time, a Pakistani-type dress that had been all the rage in her Kabul life appeared in her wardrobe. Sometimes a wife of one of Muskanyar's friends would be brought to the house for treatment. Yet Hila could not brighten, no matter how she tried. As always, Muskanyar, summoning a seemingly endless reserve of hope, refused to give in. Yet his optimism now faced challenges on multiple fronts. If life at home was trying, things around the district were not faring any better. It started in that summer of 2003, when a motorist was mysteriously gunned down not far from the village. Later, a farmer was kidnapped, and another was held up at gunpoint. Someone fired rockets at the nearby American base. Hila ordered the children to stop playing outside. Muskanyar ate his dinners in silence, brooding over things better left unsaid. The war had returned.